but it might not be her.
Simon stared down at the phone as the full horror of the situation buzzed around his brain like a ghoul buzzing around the outside of a house, begging to be let in.
Focus, he told himself. Don't panic. It might be Isabel.
Oh, Jesus. Jordan glowered at him.
Do you have any other girlfriends?
Do we have to make a list of names to call? Simon yanked the phone away from him and turned away, punching in the number. Maya answered on the second ring.
Hello?
Maya, it's Simon.
The friendliness went out of her voice.
Oh.
What do you want? I just wanted to check in that you were okay, he said.
I'm fine,
she spoke stiffly.
It's not like what was going on with us was all that serious. I'm not happy, but I'll live. You're still an ass, though.
No, Simon said.
I mean, I wanted to check that you were okay.
Is this about Jordan?
He could hear the tense anger when she said his name.
Right. You guys went off together, didn't you? You're friends or something, right?
Well, you can tell him to stay away from me. In fact, that goes for the both of you.
She hung up. The dial tone buzzed down the phone line like an angry bee. Simon looked at Jordan.
She's fine. She hates us both, but it really didn't sound like anything else was wrong.
Fine, Jordan said tightly. Call Isabel. It took two tries before Izzy picked up. Simon was nearly in a panic by the time a voice came down the line, sounding distracted and annoyed.
Whoever this is, it had better be good.
Relief poured through his veins.
Isabel, it's Simon.
Oh, for God's sake, what do you want?
I just wanted to make sure you were okay.
Oh.
What, I'm supposed to be devastated because you're a cheating, lying, two-timing son of a... No.
This was really starting to wear on Simon's nerves.
I meant, are you all right? You haven't been kidnapped or anything.
There was a long silence.
Simon, Isabel said finally, this is really, seriously, the stupid excuse for a whiny makeup call that I have ever, ever heard. What's wrong with you?
I'm not sure,
Simon said, and hung up before she could hang up on him. He handed the phone to Jordan.
She's fine, too.
I don't get it. Jordan looked bewildered. Who makes a threat like that if it's totally empty? I mean, it's so easy to check and find out it's a lie.
They must think I'm stupid,
Simon began, and then paused, a horrible thought dawning on him. He snatched the phone back from Jordan and started to dial with numb fingers.
Who is it? Jordan said. Who are you calling?
Clary's phone rang just as she turned the corner of 96th Street onto Riverside Drive. The rain seemed to have washed away the city's usual dirt. The sun shone down from a brilliant sky onto the bright green strip of the park running alongside the river, whose water looked nearly blue today. She dug into her bag for her phone, found it, and flipped it open. Hello? Simon's voice came down the line. Oh, thank, he broke off. Are you all right? You're not kidnapped or anything. Kidnapped? Clary peered up at the numbers of the buildings as she walked uptown. 220, 224. She wasn't entirely sure what she was looking for. Would it look like a church? Something else? Glamored to look like an abandoned lot? Are you drunk or something? It's a little early for that. The relief in his voice was plain. No, I got a weird note. Someone threatening to go after my girlfriend. Which one? Hardy har. Simon did not sound amused. I called Maya and Isabel already, and they're both fine. Then I thought of you. I mean, we spend a lot of time together. Someone might get the wrong idea, but now I don't know what to think. I don't know. 232 Riverside Drive loomed up in front of Clary suddenly, a big square stone building with a pointed roof. It could have been a church at one point, she thought, though it didn't look much like one now. Maya and Isabel found out about each other last night, by the way. It wasn't pretty, Simon added. You were right about the playing with fire bit. Clary examined the facade of number 232. Most of the edifices lining the drive were expensive apartment buildings, with a doorman in livery waiting inside. This one, though, had only a set of tall wooden doors with curved tops and old-fashioned-looking metal handles instead of doorknobs. Ooh, ouch. Sorry, Simon. Are either of them speaking to you? Not really. She took hold of one of the handles and pushed. The door slid open with a soft, hissing noise. Clary dropped her voice. Maybe one of them left the note. It doesn't really seem like their style, said Simon, sounding genuinely puzzled. Do you think Jace would have done it? The sound of his name was like a punch to the stomach. Clary caught her breath and said, I really don't think he'd do that, even if he was angry. She drew the phone away from her ear. Peering around the half-open door, she could see what looked reassuringly like the inside of a normal church, a long aisle and flickering lights like candles. Surely it couldn't hurt just to take a peek inside. I have to go, Simon, she said. I'll call you later. She flipped her phone closed and stepped inside.
You really think it was a joke? Jordan was prowling up and down the apartment like a tiger pacing its cage at the zoo. I don't know. It seems like a really sick sort of a joke to me. I didn't say it wasn't sick. Simon glanced at the note. It lay on the coffee table, the block-printed letters clearly visible even at a distance. Just looking at it gave him a lurching feeling in his stomach, even though he knew it was meaningless. I'm just trying to think who might have sent it, and why. Maybe I should take the day off watching you and keep an eye on her, said Jordan. You know, just in case. I assume you're talking about Maya, said Simon. I know you mean well, but I really don't think she wants you around, in any capacity. Jordan's jaw tightened. I'd stay out of the way so she wouldn't see me. Well, you're still really into her, aren't you? I have a personal responsibility. Jordan sounded stiff. Whatever else I feel doesn't matter. You can do what you want, said Simon. But I think... The door buzzer sounded again. The two boys exchanged a single look before both bolting down the narrow hallway to the door. Jordan got there first. He grabbed for the coat rack that stood by the door, ripped the coats off it and flung the door wide open, the rack held above his head like a javelin. On the other side of the door was Jace. He blinked. Is that a coat rack? Jordan slammed the coat rack down on the ground and sighed. If you'd been a vampire, this would have been a lot more useful. Yes, said Jace. Well, you know, just someone with a lot of coats. Simon stuck his head around Jordan and said,
Sorry, we've had a stressful morning.
Yeah, well, said Jace, it's about to get more stressful. I came to bring you to the Institute, Simon. The Conclave wants to see you, and they don't like having to wait.
The moment the door of the Church of Talto shut behind Clary, she felt that she was in another world, the noise and bustle of New York City entirely shut out. The space inside the building was big and lofty, with high ceilings soaring above. There was a narrow aisle banked by rows of pews, and fat brown candles burned in sconces bolted along the walls. The interior seemed dimly lit to Clary, but perhaps that was just because she was used to the brightness of witchlight. She moved along the aisle, the tread of her sneakers soft against the dusty stone. It was odd, she thought. A church with no windows at all. At the end of the aisle, she reached the apse, where a set of stone steps led to a podium on which was displayed an altar. She blinked up at it, realizing what else was strange. There were no crosses in this church. Instead, there was an upright stone tablet on the altar, crowned by the carved figure of an owl. The words on the tablet read, For her house inclineth unto death, and her paths unto the dead. None that go unto her return again, neither take they hold of the paths of life. Clary blinked. She wasn't too familiar with the Bible. She certainly didn't have anything like Jace's near-perfect recall of large passages of it. But while that sounded religious, It was also an odd bit of text to feature in a church. She shivered and drew closer to the altar, where a large closed book had been left out. One of the pages seemed to be marked. When Clary reached to open the book, she realized that what she'd thought was a bookmark was a black-handled dagger carved with occult symbols. She'd seen pictures of these before in her textbooks. It was an athame, often used in demonic summoning rituals. Her stomach went cold, but she bent to scan the marked page anyway, determined to learn something, only to discover that it had been written in a cramped, stylized hand that would have been hard to decipher had the book been in English. It wasn't. It was in a sharp, spiky-looking alphabet that she was sure she'd never seen before. The words were below an illustration of what Clary recognized as a summoning circle, the kind of pattern warlocks traced on the ground before they enacted spells. The circles were meant to draw down and concentrate magical power. This one, splashed across the page in green ink, looked like two concentric circles with a square in the center of them. In the space between the circles, runes were scrawled. Clary didn't recognize them, but she could feel the language of the runes in her bones, and it made her shiver. Death and blood. She turned the page hastily and came on a group of illustrations that made her suck in her breath. It was a progression of pictures that started with the image of a woman with a bird perched on her left shoulder. The bird, possibly a raven, looked sinister and cunning. In the second picture, the bird was gone, and the woman was obviously pregnant. In the third image, the woman was lying on an altar, not unlike the one Clary was standing in front of now. A robed figure was standing in front of her, a jarringly modern-looking syringe in its hand. The syringe was full of dark red liquid. The woman clearly knew she was about to be injected with it, because she was screaming. In the last picture, the woman was sitting with a baby on her lap. The baby looked almost normal, except that its eyes were entirely black, without whites at all. The woman was looking down at her child with a look of terror. Clary felt the hairs on the back of her neck prickle. Her mother had been right. Someone was trying to make more babies like Jonathan. In fact, they already had. She stepped back from the altar. Every nerve in her body was screaming that there was something very wrong with this place. She didn't think she could spend another second here. Better to go outside and wait there for the cavalry to arrive. She might have discovered this clue on her own, but the result was way more than she could handle on her own. It was then that she heard the sound. A soft susurration, like a slow tide pulling back, that seemed to come from above her. She looked up, the athame gripped firmly in her hand, and stared. All around the upstairs gallery stood rows of silent figures. They wore what looked like gray tracksuits, sneakers, dull gray sweats, and zip-up tops with hoods pulled down over their faces. They were utterly motionless, their hands on the gallery railing staring down at her. At least, she assumed they were staring. Their faces were hidden entirely in shadow. She couldn't even tell if they were male or female.
I'm sorry, she said. Her voice echoed loudly in the stone room. I didn't mean to intrude, or...
There was no answer but silence. Silence like a weight. Clary's heart began to beat faster.
I'll just go, then, she said, swallowing hard.
She stepped forward, laid the athame on the altar, and turned to leave. She caught the scent on the air then. A split second before she turned, the familiar stench of rotting garbage. Between her and the door, rising up like a wall, was a nightmarish mishmash of scaled skin, blade-like teeth, and reaching claws. For the past 7 weeks, Clary had trained to face down a demon in battle,
even a massive one. But now that it was actually happening, all she could do was scream. Chapter 11. Our Kind. The demon lunged for Clary, and she stopped screaming abruptly and flung herself backward over the altar, a perfect flip. And for one bizarre moment, she wished Jace had been there to see it. She hit the ground in a crouch, just as something struck the altar hard, making the stone vibrate. A howl sounded through the church. Clary scrambled to her knees and peered over the edge of the altar. The demon wasn't as big as she'd first thought, but it wasn't small either, about the size of a refrigerator, with three heads on swaying stalks. The heads were blind, with enormous gaping jaws from which ropes of greenish drool hung. The demon seemed to have smacked its leftmost head on the altar when it grabbed for her, because it was shaking the head back and forth as if trying to clear it. Clary glanced up wildly, but the tracksuited figures were still where they had been before. None of them had moved. They seemed to be watching what was going on with a detached interest. She spun and looked behind her, but there appeared to be no exits from the church besides the door she'd come through, and the demon was currently blocking her path back to it. Realizing she was wasting precious seconds, she scrambled to her feet and grabbed for the athame. She yanked it off the altar and ducked back down just as the demon came for her again. She rolled to the side as a head, swaying on a thick stalk of neck, darted over the altar, its thick black tongue flicking out, searching for her. With a scream, she jammed the athame into the creature's neck, once, then jerked it free, scrambling backward and out of the way. The thing screamed, its head rearing back, black blood spraying from the wound she'd made. But it wasn't a killing blow. Even as Clary watched, the wound began to heal. Slowly, the demon's blackish-green flesh knitting together like fabric being sewed up. Her heart sank. Of course. The whole reason Shadowhunters use runed weapons was that the runes prevented demons from healing. She reached for the steely in her belt with her left hand and yanked it free just as the demon came for her again. She leaped to the side and threw herself painfully down the stairs, rolling until she fetched up against the first row of pews. The demon turned, lumbering a bit as it moved, and made for her again. Realizing she was still clutching both the steely and the dagger, in fact, the dagger had cut her as she had rolled, and blood was quickly staining the front of her jacket, she transferred the dagger to her left hand, the steely to her right, and with a desperate swiftness cut an Inkele rune into the athame's hilt. The other symbols on the hilt began to melt and run as the rune of angelic power took hold. Clary looked up. The demon was almost on her, its three heads reaching, their mouths gaping. Propelling herself to her feet, she drew her arm back and flung the dagger as hard as she could. To her great surprise, it struck the middle head right in the center of the skull, sinking in up to the hilt. The head thrashed as the demon screamed. Clary's heart lifted, and then the head simply dropped, hitting the ground with a sickening thud. The demon kept coming anyway, dragging the now-dead head on its limp neck after it as it moved toward Clary. The sound of many footsteps came from above. Clary looked up. The tracksuited figures were gone, the gallery empty. The sight was not reassuring. Her heart doing a wild tango in her chest, Clary turned and ran for the front door, but the demon was faster than she was. With a grunt of effort, it launched itself over her and landed in front of the doors, blocking her way out. Making a hissing noise, it moved toward her, its two living heads swaying, then rising, stretching to their full length in order to strike at her. Something flashed through the air, a darting flame of silvery gold. The demon's heads whipped around, the hissing rising to a scream, but it was too late. The silvery thing that encircled them pulled tight, and with a spray of blackish blood, its remaining two heads sheared away. Clary rolled out of the way as flying blood splattered her, searing her skin. Then she ducked her head as the headless body swayed, fell toward her, and was gone. As it was collapsing, the demon vanished, sucked back to its home dimension. Clary raised her head cautiously. The front doors of the church were open, and in the entranceway stood Isabel, in boots and a black dress, her electrum whip in hand. She was winding it back slowly around her wrist, glancing around the church as she did so, her dark eyebrows drawn together in a curious frown. As her gaze fell on Clary, she grinned. "Damn, girl," she said. "What have you gotten yourself into now?"
The touch of the vampire servant's hands on Simon's skin was cold and light, like the touch of icy wings. He shuddered a little as they unwound the blindfold from around his head, their withered skin rough on his, before they stepped back, bowing as they retreated. He looked around, blinking. Moments ago he had been standing in the sunlight on the corner of 78th Street and 2nd Avenue, enough of a distance from the Institute that he had judged it safe to use the grave dirt to contact Camille without arousing her suspicions. Now he was in a dimly lit room, quite large, with a smooth marble floor and elegant marble pillars holding up a high ceiling. Along the left wall ran a row of glass-fronted cubicles, each with a brass-lettered plaque hanging over it that read Teller. Another brass plaque on the wall proclaimed this to be the Douglas National Bank. Thick layers of dust padded the floor and the counters, where people had once stood to write out checks or withdrawal slips, and the brass-bound lamps that hung from the ceiling were coated with verdigris. In the center of the room was a high armchair, and in the chair sat Camille. Her silvery blonde hair was undone, and rained down over her shoulders like tinsel. Her beautiful face had been wiped clean of makeup, but her lips were still very red. In the dimness of the bank, they were almost the only color Simon could see.
"I would not normally agree to meet during sunlight hours, Daylighter," she said. "But since it is you, I have made an exception."
"Thank you."
He noticed no chair had been provided for him, so he continued awkwardly standing. If his heart still beat, he thought, it would have been pounding. When he had agreed to do this for the conclave, he had forgotten how much Camille scared him. Maybe it was illogical. What could she really do to him? But there it was.
"I suppose this means you have considered my offer," said Camille, "and that you agree to it."
"What makes you think I agree?"
Simon said, very much hoping that she wouldn't put down the fatuousness of the question to the fact he was stalling for time. She looked mildly impatient.
"You would hardly deliver in person the news that you had decided to refuse me. You would be afraid of my temper."
"Should I be afraid of your temper?"
Camille sat back in the wing chair, smiling. The chair was modern-looking and luxurious, unlike anything else in the abandoned bank. It must have been hauled here from somewhere else, probably by Camille's servants, who were currently standing off to each side like silent statues.
"Minia," she said, "but you have no reason to be. I am very pleased with you. Though you waited until the last moment to contact me, I sense you have made the right decision."
Simon's phone chose that minute to begin buzzing insistently. He jumped, feeling a trickle of cold sweat going down his back, then fished it hastily out of the pocket of his jacket.
"Sorry,"
he said, flipping it open.
"Phone."
Camille looked horrified.
"Do not answer that."
Simon began lifting the phone to his ear. As he did, he managed to hit the camera button several times with his finger.
"It'll just take a second,
Simon." He hit the send button, then quickly flipped the phone closed.
"Sorry, I didn't think."
Camille's chest was rising and falling with rage, despite the fact she didn't actually breathe.
"I demand more respect than that from my servants," she hissed. "You will never do that again, or..."
"Or what?"
Simon said.
"You can't hurt me any more than anyone else can. And I told you I wouldn't be a servant. You told me I'd be your partner."
He paused, letting just the right note of arrogance into his voice.
"Maybe I ought to reconsider my acceptance of your offer."
Camille's eyes darkened. "Oh, for God's sake, do not be a little fool."
"How can you say that word?"
Simon demanded. Camille raised delicate eyebrows.
"Which word? Are you annoyed that I called you a fool?"
"No. Well, yes, but that's not what I meant. You said, oh, for..."
He broke off, his voice cracking. He still couldn't say it. "God."
"Because I do not believe in him, silly boy," said Camille.
"And you still do." She tilted her head to the side, regarding him the way a bird might regard a worm on the sidewalk that it was considering eating.
I think perhaps it's time for a blood oath.
A blood oath?
Simon wondered if he heard right.
I forget that your knowledge of the customs of our kind is so limited.
Camille shook her silvery head.
I will have you sign an oath, in blood, that you are loyal to me. It will prevent you from disobeying me in the future. Consider it a sort of prenuptial agreement.
She smiled, and he saw the glint of her fangs.
Come.
She snapped her fingers imperiously, and a minion scurried toward her, their gray heads bent. The first to reach her handed her something that looked like an old-fashioned glass pen, the kind with a whorled tip meant to catch and hold ink.
You will have to cut yourself and draw your own blood, said Camille. Normally, I would do it myself, but the mark prevents me. Therefore, we must improvise.
Simon hesitated. This was bad. Very bad. He knew enough about the supernatural world to know what oaths meant to downworlders. They were not just empty promises that could be broken. They truly bound the promiser, like virtual manacles. If he signed the oath, he really would be loyal to Camille. Possibly forever.
Come along, Camille said, a touch of impatience creeping into her voice. There is no need to dawdle.
Swallowing, Simon took a reluctant step forward, and then another. A servant stepped in front of him, blocking his way. He was holding out a knife to Simon, a wicked-looking thing with a needle blade. Simon took it and raised it above his wrist. Then he lowered it.
You know, he said, I really don't like pain very much. Or knives.
Do it, Camille growled.
There has to be some other way.
Camille rose from her chair and Simon saw that her fangs were fully extended. She was truly enraged.
If you do not stop wasting my time.
There was a soft implosion, a sound like something enormous tearing down the middle. A great shimmering panel appeared against the opposite wall. Camille turned toward it, her lips parting in shock as she saw what it was. Simon knew she recognized it, just as he did. There was only one thing it could be. A portal, and through it were pouring at least a dozen shadow hunters.
Okay, said Isabel, putting away the first aid kit with a brisk gesture. They were in one of the Institute's many spare rooms, meant to house visiting Clave members. Each was plainly furnished with a bed, a dresser, and a wardrobe, and a small bathroom. And of course, each one had a first aid kit, with bandages, poultices, and even spare steelies included. You're pretty well erotzed up. But it's going to take a little while for some of those bruises to fade. And these. She ran her hand over the burn marks on Clary's forearm where the demon blood had splashed her. Probably won't go away totally till tomorrow. If you rest, they'll heal faster, though. That's fine. Thanks, Isabel. Clary looked down at her hands. There were bandages around the right one, and her shirt was still torn and blood-stained, though Izzy's runes had healed the cuts beneath. She supposed she could have done the erotzes herself, but it was nice to have someone take care of her, and Izzy, while not the warmest person Clary knew, could be capable and kind when she felt like it. And thanks for showing up, and you know, saving my life from whatever that was. A Hydra demon. I told you. They have a lot of heads, but they're pretty dumb. And you weren't doing such a bad job with it before I showed up. I like what you did with the Athame. Good thinking under pressure. That's as much a part of being a shadow hunter as learning how to punch holes in things. Isabel flopped down onto the bed next to Clary and sighed. I should probably go look up what I can find about the Church of Talto before the Conclave gets back. Maybe it'll help us figure out what's going on. The hospital stuff. The babies. She shuddered. I don't like it. Clary had told Isabel as much as she could about why she'd been at the church, even about the demon baby at the hospital, though she'd pretended she was the one who'd been suspicious and had kept her mother out of the story. Isabel had looked sick when Clary had described the way the baby had looked exactly like a normal baby, except for its open black eyes and the little claws it had instead of hands. I think they were trying to make another baby like my brother. I think they experimented on some poor mundane woman, Clary said. But she couldn't take it when the baby was born, and she lost her mind. It's just, who would do something like that? One of Valentine's followers? The ones who never got caught? Maybe trying to carry on what he was doing? Maybe. Or just some demon-worshipping cult. There are plenty of them. Although, I can't imagine why anyone would want to make more creatures like Sebastian. Her voice gave a little jump of hatred when she said his name. His name's really Jonathan. Jonathan is Jace's name, said Isabel tightly. I won't call that monster by the same name my brother has. He's always going to be Sebastian to me. Clary had to admit Isabel had a point. She had a hard time thinking of him as Jonathan, too. She supposed it wasn't fair to the true Sebastian, but none of them had really known him. It was easier to slap a stranger's name onto Valentine's vicious son than call him something that made him feel closer to her family, closer to her life. Isabel spoke lightly, but Clary could tell her mind was working, ticking over various possibilities. Anyway, I'm glad you texted me when you did. I could tell from your message that something weird was going on, and frankly, I was bored. Everyone's off doing some secret thing with the conclave, and I didn't want to go because Simon was going to be there, and I hate him now. Simon is with the conclave? Clary was astonished. She had noticed that the Institute had seemed even more empty than usual when they'd arrived. Jace, of course, wasn't there, but she hadn't expected him to be, though she hadn't known why. I talked to him this morning, and he didn't say anything about doing something for them, Clary added. Isabel shrugged. It has something to do with vampire politics, that's all I know. Do you think he's all right? Isabel sounded exasperated. He doesn't need you to protect him anymore, Clary. He has the mark of Cain. He could get blown up, shot at, drowned, and stabbed, and he'd be just fine. She looked at Clary hard. I notice you didn't ask me why I hate Simon, she said. I assume you knew about the two-timing thing. I knew, Clary admitted. I'm sorry. Isabel waved her confession away. You're his best friend. It would have been weird if you didn't know. I should have told you, Clary said. It's just, I never got the sense you were that serious about Simon, you know? Isabel scowled. I wasn't. It's just, I thought he would take it seriously, at least, since I was so out of his league and everything. I guess I expected better from him than I do from other guys. Maybe, Clary said quietly. Simon shouldn't be dating someone who thinks they're out of his league. Isabel looked at her, and Clary felt herself flush. Sorry, your relationship is really none of my business. Isabel was twisting her dark hair up into a knot, something she did when she felt tense. No, it isn't. I mean, I could ask you why you texted me to come to the church and meet you, and not Jace, but I haven't. I'm not stupid. I know something's wrong between you two, passionate alley make-out sessions notwithstanding. She looked keenly at Clary. Have the two of you slept together yet? Clary felt the blood rush into her face. What? I mean, no, we haven't, but I don't see what that has to do with anything. It doesn't, said Isabel, patting her knotted hair into place. That was just prurient curiosity. What's holding you back? Isabel. Clary pulled up her legs, wrapped her arms around her knees, and sighed. Nothing. We were just taking our time. I've never, you know. Jace has, said Isabel. I mean, I assume he has. I don't know for sure. But if you ever need anything, she let the sentence hang in the air. Need anything? Protection? You know. So you can be careful, Isabel said. She sounded as practical as if she were talking about extra buttons. You'd think the angel would have been foresighted enough to give us a birth control rune, but no dice. Of course I'd be careful, Clary spluttered, feeling her cheeks turn red. Enough, this is awkward. This is girl talk, said Isabel. You just think it's awkward because you've spent your whole life with Simon as your only friend, and you can't talk to him about Jace. That would be awkward.
And Jace really hasn't said anything to you? About what's bothering him? Clary said in a small voice. You promise? He didn't have to, Isabel said. The way you've been acting, and with Jace going around looking like someone just died, it's not like I wouldn't notice something was wrong. You should have come to talk to me sooner. Is he at least all right? Clary asked very quietly.
Isabel stood up from the bed and looked down at her. No, she said. He is very much not all right.
Are you?
Clary shook her head.
I didn't think so, Isabel said.
To Simon's surprise, Camille, upon seeing the Shadow Hunters, didn't even try to stand her ground. She screamed and ran for the door, only to freeze when she realized it was daylight outside, and that exiting the bank would quickly incinerate her. She gasped and cowered back against the wall, her fangs bared, a low hiss coming from her throat. Simon stepped back as the Shadow Hunters of the Conclave swarmed around him, all in black like a murder of crows. He saw Jace, his face pale and set like white marble, slide a broadsword blade through one of the human servants as he passed him, as casually as a pedestrian might swat a fly. Maris stalked ahead, her flying black hair reminding Simon of Isabel. She dispatched the second cowering minion with a whipsaw movement of her seraph blade, and advanced on Camille, her shining blade outstretched. Jace was beside her, and another Shadow Hunter, a tall man with black runes twining his forearms like vines, was on her other side. The rest of the Shadow Hunters had spread out, and were canvassing the bank, sweeping it with those odd things they used, sensors, checking every corner for demon activity. They ignored the bodies of Camille's human servants, lying motionless in their pools of drying blood. They ignored Simon as well. He might as well have been another pillar, for all the attention they paid him.
Camille Belcourt, said Maris, her voice echoing off the marble walls. You have broken the law, and you are subject to the law's punishments. Will you surrender and come with us, or will you fight?
Camille was crying, making no attempt to cover her tears, which were tinged with blood. They streaked her white face with red lines as she choked.
Walker, and my archer.
Maris looked baffled. She turned to the man on her left.
What is she saying, Kadir?
Her human servants, he replied. I believe she is mourning their deaths.
Maris flipped her hand dismissively.
It is against the law to make servants of human beings.
I made them before, downworlders were subject to your accursed laws, you bitch. They have been with me for 200 years. They were like children to me.
Maris's hand tightened on the hilt of her blade.
What would you know of children? She whispered. What does your kind know of anything but destroying?
Camille's tear-streaked face flashed for a moment with triumph.
I knew it, she said. Whatever else you might say, whatever lies you tell, you hate our kind, don't you?
Maris's face tightened.
Take her, she said. Bring her to the sanctuary.
Jace moved swiftly to one side of Camille and took hold of her. Kadir seized the other arm. Together they pinioned her between them.
Camille Belcourt, you stand accused of the murder of humans,
Maris intoned,
and the murder of Shadow Hunters. You will be taken to the sanctuary, where you will be questioned. The sentence for the murder of Shadow Hunters is death, but it is possible, if you cooperate with us, your life will be spared. Do you understand? Asked Maris.
Camille tossed her head defiantly.
There is only one man I will answer to, she said. If you do not bring him to me, I will tell you nothing. You can kill me, but I will tell you nothing.
Very well, said Maris. What man is that?
Camille bared her teeth.
Magnus Bane.
Magnus Bane?
Maris looked flabbergasted.
The High Warlock of Brooklyn? Why do you want to talk to him?
I will answer to him, Camille said again. Or I will answer to no one.
And that was that. She said not another word. As she was dragged away by the Shadow Hunters, Simon watched her go. He did not feel as he thought he would, triumphant. He felt hollow and strangely sick to his stomach. He looked down at the bodies of the slain servants. He hadn't liked them much either, but they hadn't asked to be what they were. Not really. In a way, maybe neither had Camille. But she was a monster to Nephilim anyway. and maybe not just because she had killed Shadowhunters. Maybe there was no way, really, for them to think of her as anything else. Camilla had been pushed through the portal. Jay stood on the other side of it, gesturing impatiently for Simon to follow.
Are you coming or not?
He called.
Whatever else you might say, whatever lies you tell, you hate that kind.
Coming, Simon said, and moved reluctantly forward. Chapter 12. Sanctuary.
What do you think Camille wants to see Magnus for? Simon asked.
He and Jace were standing against the back wall of the sanctuary, which was a massive room attached to the main body of the Institute through a narrow passageway. It wasn't part of the Institute per se. It had been left deliberately unconsecrated in order that it might be used as a holding place for demons and vampires. Sanctuaries, Jace had informed Simon, had gone out of fashion somewhat since projecting had been invented. But every once in a while, they found a use for theirs. Apparently, this was one of those times. It was a big room, stone-bound and pillared, with an equally stone-bound entryway beyond a wide set of double doors. The entryway led to the corridor connecting the room to the Institute. Huge gouges in the stone floor indicated that whatever had been caged here over the years had been pretty nasty and big. Simon couldn't help wondering how many enormous rooms full of pillars he was going to have to spend time in. Camille was standing against one of the pillars, her arms behind her, guarded on either side by Shadowhunter warriors. Maris was pacing back and forth, occasionally conferring with Kadir, clearly trying to sort out some kind of plan. There were no windows in the room, for obvious reasons, but witchlight torches burned everywhere, giving the whole scene a peculiar whitish cast.
I don't know, Jace said. Maybe she wants fashion tips.
Ha, Simon said. Who's that guy with your mother? He looks familiar.
That's Kadir, said Jace. You probably met his brother Malik. He died in the attack on Valentine's ship. Kadir is the second most important person in the Conclave, after my mom. She relies on him a lot.
As Simon watched, Kadir pulled Camille's arms behind her back, so they circled the pillar and chained them at her wrists. The vampire gave a little scream.
Blessed metal, said Jace, without a flicker of emotion. It burns them.
Damn, Simon thought. You mean you. I'm just like her. I'm no different just because you know me.
Camille was whimpering. Kadir stood back, his face impassive. Runes, dark against his skin, twined the entirety of his arms and throat. He turned to say something to Maris. Simon caught the words. Magnus. And fire message.
Magnus again, said Simon. But isn't he traveling?
Magnus and Camille are both really old, said Jace. I suppose it's not that odd that they know each other.
He shrugged, seemingly uninterested in the topic.
Anyway, I'm pretty sure they're going to wind up summoning Magnus back here. Maris wants information, and she wants it bad. She knows Camille wasn't killing those Shadowhunters just for blood. There are easier ways to get blood.
Simon thought fleetingly of Marine, and felt sick.
Well, he said, trying to sound unconcerned. I guess that means Alec will be back, so that's good, right?
Sure.
Jace's voice sounded lifeless. He didn't look all that great either. The whitish light in the room cast the angles of his cheekbones into a new and sharper relief, showing that he'd lost weight. His fingernails were bitten down to bloody stumps, and there were dark shadows under his eyes.
At least your plan worked,
Simon added, trying to inject some cheer into Jace's misery. It had been Jace's idea to have Simon take a picture with his cell phone and send it to the Conclave, which would allow them to portal to where he was.
It was a good idea.
I knew it would work.
Jace sounded bored by the compliment. He looked up as the double doors to the Institute swung open, and Isabel came through them, her black hair swinging. She looked around the room, giving Camille and the other Shadowhunters barely a glance, and came toward Jace and Simon, her boots clattering against the stone.
What's this all about yanking poor Magnus and Alec back from their vacation? Isabel demanded. They have opera tickets.
Jace explained, while Isabel stood with her hands on her hips, ignoring Simon completely.
Fine, she said when he was done. But the whole thing's ridiculous. She's just stalling for time. What could she possibly have to say to Magnus?
She glanced back over her shoulder at Camille, who was now not just manacled, but bound to the pillar with lengths of silvery gold chain. It crisscrossed her body across her torso, her knees, and even her ankles, holding her totally immobile.
Is that blessed metal?
Jace nodded.
The manacles are lined to protect her wrists, but if she moves too much, he made a sizzling sound.
Simon, remembering the way his hands had burned when he touched the Star of David in his cell in Idris, the way his skin had run with blood, had to fight the urge to snap at him.
"Well, while you were trapping vampires, I was uptown fighting off a Hydra demon," Isabel said. "With Clary."
Jace, who had evinced only the barest interest in anything going on around him until now, jerked upright.
"With Clary? You took her demon hunting with you?"
"Isabel." "Of course not. She was already well into the fight by the time I got there."
"But how did you know?"
"She texted me," Isabel said, "so I went."
She examined her nails, which were, as usual, perfect.
"She texted you?"
Jace grabbed Isabel by the wrist.
"Is she all right? Did she get hurt?"
Isabel looked down at his hand gripping her wrist and then back up to his face. If he was hurting her, Simon couldn't tell, but the look on her face could have cut glass, as could the sarcasm in her voice.
"Yeah, she's bleeding to death upstairs, but I thought I'd avoid telling you right away, because I like to draw the suspense out."
Jace, as if suddenly conscious of what he was doing, let go of Isabel's wrist.
"She's here?"
"She's upstairs," Isabel said, "resting."
But Jace was already gone, running for the entryway doors. He burst through them and vanished. Isabel, looking after him, shook her head.
"You can't really have thought he was going to do anything else," said Simon.
For a moment she said nothing. He wondered if maybe she was just planning to ignore anything he said for the rest of eternity.
"I know," she said finally. "I just wish I knew what was going on with them. I'm not sure they know."
Isabel was worrying at her bottom lip. She looked very young all of a sudden, and unusually conflicted for Isabel. Something was clearly going on with her, and Simon waited quietly until she appeared to come to a decision.
"I don't want to be like that," she said. "Come on, I want to talk to you."
She started to head toward the Institute doors.
"You do?"
Simon was astonished. She spun and glared at him.
"Right now I do, but I can't promise how long it'll last."
Simon held his hands up.
"I want to talk to you, Iz, but I can't go into the Institute."
A line appeared between her eyebrows.
"Why?"
She broke off, looking from him to the doors, to Camille and back again.
"All right, how did you get in here then?"
"Portaled," said Simon.
"But Jay said there's an entryway that leads to a set of doors that go outside, so vampires can enter here at night."
He pointed to a narrow door set in the wall a few feet away. It was secured with a rusting iron bolt, as if it hadn't been used in a while. Isabel shrugged.
"Fine."
The bolt made a screeching noise when she yanked it back, sending flakes of rust into the air in a fine red spray. Beyond the door was a small stone room, like the vestry of a church, and a set of doors that most likely led outside. There were no windows, but cold air crept around the edges of the doors, making Isabel and her short dress shiver.
"Look, Isabel," Simon said, figuring that the onus was on him to start the discussion. "I really am sorry about what I did. There's no excuse."
"No, there isn't," Isabel said.
"And while you're at it, you might want to tell me why you're hanging around with the guy who turned Meyer into a werewolf."
Simon told her the story Jordan had recounted to him, trying to keep his explanation as even-handed as he could. He felt like it was at least important to explain to Isabel that he hadn't known who Jordan really was at first, and also that Jordan regretted what he'd done.
"Not that that makes it okay," he finished. "But you know, we've all done bad things."
But he couldn't bring himself to tell her about Maureen. Not right now.
"I know," Isabel said. "And I've heard of the Praetor Lupus. If they're willing to have him as a member, he can't be a complete washout, I guess."
She looked at Simon a little more closely.
"Although, I don't get why you need someone to protect you. You have..."
She pointed at her forehead.
"I can't go through the rest of my life with people running at me every day and the mark blowing them up," Simon said. "I need to know who's trying to kill me. Jordan's helping with that. Jace, too."
"Do you really think Jordan's helping you? Because the Clave has some pull with the Praetor. We could get him replaced." Simon hesitated.
"Yeah," he said. "I really do think he's helping. And I can't always rely on the Clave."
"Okay." Isabel leaned back against the wall.
"Do you ever wonder why I'm so different from my brothers?" she asked without preamble. "Alec and Jace, I mean."
Simon blinked.
"You mean aside from the whole thing where you're a girl and they aren't?"
"No,
Not that, idiot. I mean, look at the two of them. They have no problem falling in love. They're both in love. The forever kind. They're done. Look at Jace. He loves Clary like there's nothing else in the world, and there never will be. Alex the same. MX.
Her voice caught.
I don't know what it would have been like for him, but he trusted everyone. And as you might have noticed, I don't trust anyone.
People are different, Simon said, trying to sound understanding. It doesn't mean that they're happier than you.
Sure it does, Isabel said. You think I don't know that?
She looked at Simon hard.
You know my parents.
Not well.
They had never been terribly eager to meet Isabel's vampire boyfriend, a situation that hadn't done much to ameliorate Simon's feeling that he was merely the latest in a long line of undesirable suitors.
Well, you know they were both in the circle, but I bet you didn't know it was all my mom's idea. My dad was never really enthusiastic about Valentine or any of it. And then when everything happened and they got banished and they realized they practically wrecked their lives, I think he blamed her. But they already had Alec, and were going to have me, so he stayed, even though I think he kind of wanted to leave. And then, when Alec was about 9, he found someone else.
Wow, Simon said. Your dad cheated on your mom? That's awful.
She told me, said Isabel.
I was about 13. She told me that he would have left her, but they found out she was pregnant with Max, so they stayed together and he broke it off with the other woman. My mom didn't tell me who she was. She just told me that you couldn't really trust men. And she told me not to tell anyone.
And did you tell anyone?
Not until now, Isabel said.
Simon thought of a younger Isabel, keeping the secret, never telling anyone, hiding it from her brothers, knowing things about their family that they would never know.
She shouldn't have asked you to do that, he said, suddenly angry. That wasn't fair.
Maybe, said Isabel. I thought it made me special. I didn't think about how it might have changed me. But I watched my brothers give their hearts away, and I think, don't you know better? Hearts are breakable. And I think, even when you heal, you're never what you were before.
Maybe you're better, Simon said.
I know I'm better.
You mean Clary, said Isabel.
Because she broke your heart?
Into little pieces. You know, when someone prefers their own brother over you, it isn't a confidence booster. I thought maybe once she realized it would never work out with Jace, she'd give up and come back to me, but I finally figured out that she'd never stop loving Jace, whether it was going to work out with him or not. And I knew that if she was only with me because she didn't have him, I'd rather be alone. So I ended it.
I didn't know you broke it off with her, said Isabel.
I assumed
that I had no self-respect, Simon smiled wryly.
I thought you were still in love with Clary, Isabel said, and that you couldn't be serious about anyone else.
Because you pick guys who will never be serious about you, said Simon. So you never need to be serious about them?
Isabel's eyes shone when she looked at him, but she said nothing.
I care about you, Simon said. I've always cared about you.
She took a step toward him. They were standing fairly close together in the small room, and he could hear the sound of her breathing and the fainter pulse of her heartbeat underneath. She smelled of shampoo and sweat and gardenia perfume and Shadowhunter blood. The thought of blood made him remember Maureen, and his body tensed. Isabel noticed, of course she noticed. She was a warrior, her senses finely tuned to even the slightest movement in others, and drew back, her expression tightening.
All right, she said. Well, I'm glad we talked.
Isabel.
But she was already gone. He went after her into the sanctuary, but she was moving fast. By the time the vestry door shut behind him, she was halfway across the room. He gave up and watched as she disappeared through the double doors into the institute, knowing he couldn't follow.
Clary sat up, shaking her head to clear the grogginess. It took her a moment to remember where she was, in a spare bedroom in the institute. The only light in the room, the illumination that streamed in through the single high window, it was blue light. Twilight light. She lay twisted in the blanket, her jeans, jacket, and shoes were stacked neatly on a chair near the bed. And beside her was Jace, looking down at her, as if she had conjured him up by dreaming of him. He was sitting on the bed, wearing his gear, as if he had just come from a fight, and his hair was tousled, the dim light from the window illuminating shadows under his eyes, the hollows of his temples, the bones of his cheeks. In this light, he had the extreme and almost unreal beauty of a Modigliani painting, all elongated planes and angles. She rubbed at her eyes, blinking away sleep.
"What time is it?" she said. "How long?"
He pulled her toward him and kissed her, and for a moment she froze, suddenly very conscious that all she was wearing was a thin t-shirt and underwear. Then she went boneless against him. It was the sort of lingering kiss that turned her insides to water, the sort of kiss that might have made her feel that nothing was wrong, that things were as they had been before, and he was only glad to see her. But when his hands went to lift the hem of her t-shirt, she pushed them away. "No," she said. Her fingers wrapped around his wrists. "You can't just keep grabbing at me every time you see me. It's not a substitute for actually talking." He took a ragged breath and said, "Why did you text Isabel instead of me? If you were in trouble..." "Because I knew she'd come," said Clary. "And I don't know that about you. Not right now. If something had happened to you, then I guess you would have heard about it eventually. You know, when you deigned to actually pick up the phone." She was still holding his wrists. She let go of them now, and sat back. It was hard, physically hard, to be close to him like this and not touch him. But she forced her hands down by her sides and kept them there. "Either you tell me what's wrong, or you can get out of the room." His lips parted, but he said nothing. She didn't think she'd spoken to him this harshly in a long time. "I'm sorry," he said finally. "I mean, I know, with the way I've been acting, you've got no reason to listen to me, and I probably shouldn't have come in here. But when Isabel said you were hurt, I couldn't stop myself." "Some burns," Clary said. "Nothing that matters. Everything that happens to you matters to me." "Well, that certainly explains why you haven't called me back once, and the last time I saw you, you ran away without telling me why. It's like dating a ghost." Jace's mouth quirked up slightly at the side. "Not exactly. Isabel actually dated a ghost. She could tell you." "No," Clary said. "It was a metaphor. And you know exactly what I mean." For a moment he was silent. Then he said, "Let me see the burns." She held out her arms. There were harsh red splotches on the insides of her wrists where the demon's blood had spattered. He took her wrists, very lightly, looking at her for permission first, and turned them over. She remembered the first time he had touched her, in the street outside Java Jones, searching her hands for marks she didn't have. "Demon blood," he said. "They'll go away in a few hours." "Do they hurt?" Clary shook her head. "I didn't know," he said. "I didn't know you needed me." Her voice shook. "I always need you." He bent his head and kissed the burn on her wrist. A flare of heat coursed through her like a hot spike that went from her wrist to the pit of her stomach. "I didn't realize," he said. He kissed the next burn on her forearm, and then the next, moving up her arm to her shoulder, the pressure of his body bearing her back until she was lying against the pillows looking up at him. He propped himself on his elbows so as not to crush her with his weight and looked down at her. His eyes always darkened when they kissed, as if desire changed their color in some fundamental way. He touched the white star mark on her shoulder. The one they both had, that marked them as the children of those who had had contact with angels. "I know I've been acting strange lately," he said. "But it's not you." I love you. That never changes. Then what? I think everything that happened in Idris, Valentine, Max,